Hello, this is Terrence McNally. The virus is spreading, Brexit looms, democracy in America is being abused. Let's take a break. First, here's my 2012 conversation with film director Rocco Bellic about his documentary, Happy. It features science and stories from around the world. What did he learn and what can we use? In the second half, you'll hear my 2005 conversation with U.S. Teacher of the Year, Rafe Esquith. He taught in L.A. for over 30 years, and we talk about the Hobart Shakespeareans. Members of his fifth grade classes who performed a Shakespeare play in its entirety every year.
Are you happy? How often are you happy? And what makes you happy? Does money make you happy? Your kids and your family? Your work? How about this? Do you live in an environment? Have you chosen an environment that actually values and promotes your happiness and your well-being? Do you expect that you're going to get happier? And if so, how? Rocco Bellic's Happy, a documentary that I think deserves to be widely seen, explores these sorts of questions. It weaves the latest scientific research from the field of positive psychology with stories from around the world of people whose lives illustrate what we're learning these days. When the basic approach to the pursuit of happiness that's been taken by many of us and by society in general is not delivering, this is a good time to ask some basic questions. It's also a good time to do so because we now know more than we ever have about what science can tell us about happiness. And finally, we have access to more diverse models and worldviews than we ever have before. Rocco Bellic's directorial debut, Genghis Blues, won the Sundance Audience Award and was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. He recently directed a 44-minute documentary, Dream, Cinema of the Unconscious, which was released on the Blu-ray disc with the movie Inception. And his latest film, Happy, is available on DVD and Blu-ray.
It will be available soon.
Will be available soon. And we're going to talk also about World Happy Day, a day of screenings around the globe coming up on Saturday, February 11th. And you can learn more about that at World Happy Day, all one word, worldhappyday.com. Welcome again, Rocco Bellic, to Pacifica and Free Forum.
Terrence, thank you. It's so good to be here.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work. And how do you tell the story of your personal path to the kind of work you're doing these days?
Well, I guess, first of all, I have to say I feel extremely lucky to be able to do what I've done. And in a way, this is full circle. The first time I came into KPFK, yeah. I was with a DJ here named Mario Cassetta, who sure. came with me to Tuva for my first film called Genghis Blues. And ever since then, that was basically the first thing I did out of college. And ever since then, I have fallen into these projects that just consume my life. And they're things that I always think of it in this way, that I would. These are the things I would do if I didn't have to have a real job. And so, in fact, sure enough, sometimes the financial situation appears as if I don't have a real job. But I've been extremely lucky to find things that I really believe in and care about and want to explore. And happiness is just the latest example of that. I've spent the last 6 years of my life exploring happiness, something that I thought I had a bead on. When
sure.
I first started, I thought, oh, I understand this. I'm going to share some of the ideas that I have. Little did I know that this would be a real exploration that would change my life and would take me around the world in the process.
Very good. Since I have you here, and there were probably people who didn't catch Genghis Blues, tell people what that one is, because that one is readily available on DVD,
yes,
Netflix, all those kinds of things, right?
That's right. Genghis Blues is a bizarre story of a blind American blues musician, a very talented, great guy who played with John Lee Hooker and T-Bone Walker and B.B. King, who taught himself to do this strange kind of singing called throat singing that people primarily do only in the center of Asia, where people sing 3 to 4 notes at the same time. So here's this blind blues guy who plays a steel guitar, learning this Asian form of singing, and my film is about him going over to this country called Tuva that most people have never heard of,
right,
near Mongolia, to compete in a competition of this throat singing.
And it's a wonderful film. You get a feeling for music, you get a feeling for the Tuva culture, and it's very unique. On this film, Happy, how was Tom Shadyac involved? And let me just tell people, Tom is a director of blockbuster comedies, Nutty Professor, Liar Liar, etc., Ace Ventura, who has turned, through a change in his life, to documentary. And I recommend that you see his first documentary film, I Am. And you can listen to a podcast of my interview with Tom at aworldthatjustmightwork.com or at terrencemcnally.net. Now, what was his role in this film?
Well, Tom's an amazing guy who has, as you mentioned, achieved all of these great things in the world of Hollywood and in filmmaking. But he called me one day and said he read an article in the New York Times about happiness. And it really got under his skin because it essentially said that although America is one of the richest countries in the world, we're nowhere near the happiest. We're down at number 23, I think it said. And Tom said, look, I understand this because for the last 15 years since I've been living this sort of Hollywood lifestyle in a mansion on 7 acres and I have dozens of people working for me, I have noticed that my gardener and my housekeeper have more genuine smiles on their faces than the millionaire producers and directors I work with every day in Hollywood. So I think we should explore happiness in a documentary film. So really the whole idea for this film was his idea. And then he said this sort of critical thing that all independent filmmakers want to hear. He said, I'll help you pay for it if you do it. And so so that was a blessing. It sort of gave us carte blanche to really explore, to discover what are the true causes of happiness. He said, look, if you discover something that I don't want to know, I still want to know it.
Right.
Just tell
right.
us the truth. Let's find out because this model is not working. I know people who have achieved, who are they're like gold medal winners at the model of
That's
money,
right.
power,
That's right.
fame, good looks.
They've won this game.
They have won, and many of them are not happy.
Okay. Why World Happy Day?
Well, one of the, I guess, messages of the film, or one thing that I learned in the film, I really learned from the Bushmen in the Kalahari Desert. And what they said, I asked them, I wanted to go and find out what makes people happy before we had cell phones and cars and, you know, central heating, and all these things that we sort of come to rely on in our lives. And I thought they were the perfect people to ask because they live without these. They essentially have a 20,000-year-old culture. And every single San Bushman that I spoke with said, doing things together, being together, that's what makes us happy. And I would ask, I would say, well, do you mean like hunting? And they'd say, sure, hunting's good. Do you mean building a hut? Oh, yeah, building a hut's fine. Do you mean building a fire? Sure. It didn't matter what, as long as they're together. And that lesson really stuck with me and sort of made me think about my experiences. And there's been times, you know, I've gone through ups and downs in life. And whenever I've had people with me, people I love and who I care about and who care about me, it always gets better. Things are always okay. So the idea of World Happy Day is essentially to bring people together around this idea that happiness is important, that our own individual happiness is important in many ways. It's not only it doesn't only benefit our health, our relationships, our productivity at work, our creativity. There's all these byproducts of happiness that are astounding when you think about it. In other words, everything we want to be, everything we want to achieve is improved by happiness. But that happiness isn't just good for us. It's good for our families and for our communities and essentially for the world. So the idea of World Happy Day is to bring people together to focus on happiness and to consider if there are decisions we can make, paths we can choose that will lead us towards healthier, more fulfilling, and happier lives.
Okay. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Rocco Bellick. And we're talking about Happy, a new documentary that, as you can hear, explores what's really so about the American pursuit of happiness. And you can learn more about the film at The Happy Movie, one word, thehappymovie.com. And you can learn more about Rocco and his other work at wadirum.com, which is wadirum.com. I just want to share with you something that when I was a freshman in college, 1965, and I, you know, I look back, I had Madras shirts and Weegans and a flat top, you know, and it wasn't quite the 60s yet for me. And in my introductory course to what turned out to be my major, social relations, Irvin DeVore, a great anthropologist, played a film on the Kalahari Bushmen. And he basically said exactly what you pointed out. They don't have what we have. You know, America's about to go to the moon, all this stuff. And he says, and yet they're happier. And that movie really sticks in my mind, was a changing point for me when I just went, oh, all this stuff that I've bought up till now in terms of ideas about what life's about, that movie really made me question it. So it's
and that makes a lot of sense. That's the impact it had on me. It's so profound because what it means is whether you're rich or poor, whether you're old or young, whether you have achieved success or not, whatever you are doing, wherever you are, you can achieve the fundamental building blocks of happiness, because there are people everywhere. And all of us came from somebody, from some union of two people. And whether we know our parents or not, whether it's through our colleagues at work or our friends or our fellow classmates, whoever it is, we can build communities that we can be part of. And so that to me is the most encouraging lesson about all of this, that happiness isn't something we are striving to achieve that's just beyond the horizon. It's something we can achieve. It's right here, as long as we change our attention. And that's another interesting aspect of what I learned about happiness, is how much of it is actually within our control in that sense.
Yeah. The thing I wanted to, just because you mentioned one other thing, someone else that I want to refer people to, Bill McKibben, who's now is, we know him as the activist who may be responsible for stopping the Keystone Pipeline, but he wrote a book called A Deep Economy. In which what stirred him to write that book was he read the same research about how we were at our happiest as a country in the mid-50s, and that we've become much wealthier, we have much more toys to play with, all this, and yet we are not as happy. His conclusion was it was the loss of community, very much the same thing. But I recommend it takes it looks at some of the same things from a slightly different angle. What I want to ask you now, Rocco, about the movie Happy is, how did you do the research? Mm. And I'm going to ask you, you can answer both. One, how did you track down the science?
Sure.
And then two, how did you find the stories? Because you take us to Louisiana Bayou, Namibia, co-housing in Scandinavia, villages on the island of Okinawa. So first, the science, and then the people.
Excellent. You asked the questions in the right order, because that's exactly the way we came up with them. So the first thing I did when Tom suggested this movie is I got off the phone and I got on the internet and I started looking around and immediately discovered that there is a science called positive psychology that studies happiness. It's something I'd never heard of before. And at the time, it was relatively new. This is in 2005, 2006. Yeah. And so I ordered the 8 or so books that were written by people who had done some of this research. And over the couple years that we were working on the film and developing it, more and more books came out, and that's how we found the scientists. We found the books, we read them, and we decided what was the most interesting research, and we contacted those actual people so we could find out from the horse's mouth. And then I knew from the beginning that I didn't want to make a film about people talking about happiness. That would just be a failure. And I realized that I needed to find stories of people whose lives could show us something about this science. And that was the really fun part. That was the part that was a genuine exploration, in the sense that I was asking friends. I was looking up in the positive psychology research, what careers make you happy? Which ones actually do? Is it movie star? Or what I discovered was totally different. Hospice nurse is among the happiest careers. Very counterintuitive. Because for those of you who don't know, I didn't know this at the time, hospice nurses are with patients who are literally dying, who are at their last stage of life. A woman had emailed me and said she loved my first movie and asked what I was working on now. And when I told her, she said she won a competition photographing happiness in the South. And I immediately emailed back and said, who did you photograph? Because maybe they should be in our film. And 2 or 3 months later, I was floating down the bayou watching this incredible sunset with the Cajun family, Roy and Annie Blanchard. Just amazing. So it really came randomly. Happiness and optimism are very linked. So a friend of mine said, you have to meet my friend who's writing a book on optimism. And when this author, his name is Lawrence Shorter, when he was in town from England, we met, we had a great lunch, we had a great talk for a couple hours. And he said, I'm sorry, I have to leave. I have to go interview somebody for my book. And so he said, maybe you should just come with. And for about an hour and a half, I heard him interview a woman named Melissa Moody, who told this incredible story of having been this sort of beautiful woman who had an idyllic life and 3 kids, and she had horses, and everything was perfect until one day she was literally run over by a truck. And it took her a decade to recover, and she's still not fully recovered. But she said something in that interview that just hooked me. She said, I'm happier now than before the accident. She said, despite the fact that my face has been disfigured and my marriage fell apart and all kinds of horrible things I had to experience, I have a deeper sense of who I am and where I want to be in life and my relationship with my family and my community. Now I understand that better than I ever have. So I'm happier. That just blew me away. And so she's in our film. It's really a variety of stories that just moved me to the core.
And I'm thinking there's one story that I didn't know about that's the other side, in a way, which is the Japanese story. Not the Okinawa, but the mainland.
Yeah, Japan, my producing partner is named A.G. Han Shimizu, and he told me when we started this project that in Japan there's this sort of new phenomenon of people dying from overwork. So every year, more and more people literally collapse at their tables. And I'm talking people in their mid-20s, in their mid-30s, from things like cerebral aneurysms and heart attacks and these sort of very dramatic physical ailments that the doctors agree were brought on by stress. And when you look into their lives, you discover they have been sleeping 2 hours a night for months and doing these extreme work regimens. And so we found a woman whose husband had passed away from this. And the reason why that story is so critical to us is I feel that that's the direction that most of Western culture is moving towards. We're prioritizing work and productivity. And she even says that at Toyota, efficiency is something that they say all the time. And it sounds really good. But when it means that everybody is working to the maximum and they're getting no time to play and there's no free time to just think and just to be, that those people are literally collapsing. Mm-hmm. So I thought that this is an important story because it's sort of a warning sign for those of us who are on that treadmill, who are running as fast as we can, who are always trying to catch up, always trying to get that promotion and move ahead, that maybe that's not ultimately the right path for us as individuals and us as a country.
Right. And there's a scene in there after this husband dies of a woman who's in a choir.
Yes.
Of people who've all lost somebody to this overwork. It's very unsettling. Mm-hmm. Going back to the questions that I raised in the intro, so now you're not asking for yourself, you're asking for what you found. Are people happy?
Yes. One of the first things I discovered, and this was really sort of inspiring, is that most people are mildly happy most of the time. So we may look around and read the newspaper and read about all these horrible things and serial killers and all this, but basically most of us are happy most of the time. And I think it gives us an evolutionary advantage, and that enables us to survive because, again, happiness deals with optimism, it linked to optimism. So, you know, it makes us say, okay, I think this is worth it. Whatever I'm doing, whether I'm farming or raising a family, this is worth it. This is okay. But what we discovered is that there's a huge gap in the happiness that people have and the happiness that people can achieve. And it may seem sort of silly to just try and be as happy as you can, but if you are at a level that's where you're not optimized, you're really sacrificing all of these other things in your life. So if you care about your career, let's say for me as a filmmaker, happiness will help me find creative solutions to problems. Happiness gives me the hope and the ideas to move forward and helps me deal with problems when they arise. So happiness sort of has all of these positive byproducts. And so there is a great reason, essentially for everyone, to at least consider whether it's worth trying to be happy or not. There's a bit of research that I thought was really interesting also, that for certain careers, you don't necessarily want to be happy. They're very few, but they're there. And one of them is air traffic controller. And as I mentioned, you know, the link of optimism and happiness, you can imagine an air traffic controller who's very happy and optimistic will say, oh, don't worry about it, they'll be fine, they won't hit each other, right? So there's certain times when it's good to have that stress, to focus, to not look at the bright side and say, well, we need to consider what happens.
What's the worst case scenario?
That's right.
And
very
and deal
critical.
From that.
That's right.
Yeah.
So happiness isn't, the goal isn't to be happy all the time, extremely happy. The goal is to be able to be as happy as you can most of the time. And that helps you deal with it the correct way. So you don't freak out about small stuff too much. You might freak out a little bit just the right amount.
Yeah, that's what you want is the appropriate. I'm Terrence, you know, I'm speaking with Rocco Bellick. He's the director of Happy, a new documentary that explores what's really so about the pursuit of happiness. You can learn more about the film at thehappymovie.com and more about Rocco at wadirum.com, W-A-D-I-R-U-M, wadirum.com. And World Happy Day, which is your creation?
Yes.
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 And will be marked by community screenings of the film. And if you want to either find one or set one up, then you go to worldhappyday.com.
That's
exactly
right.
So all three websites. Okay, so what did you find makes people happy?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you one that's sort of obvious, and we touched on it, which is relationships. Most of our grandparents have told us, you know, be good to people, love your family, be good to them. We learned how critical those relationships are. So I asked Ed Diener, who studied happiness for 30 years, probably longer than anyone else in America, from a scientific perspective. I said, is there a key to happiness? You know, what is it? He said, well, the formula is different. You know, some people need a job that's very fulfilling to them. So when they come home after a day at work, they feel like they've done something with their lives. Other people need a job that just supplies enough resources and free time so they can do the things that fulfill them, like being with their families or, you know, going fishing or whatever it is. He said, but every single person in over 30 years that he studied who is happy had strong relationships with friends or family. It didn't mean that they were very social. Didn't mean they loved everybody. But it means that there was at least one or two people in their lives who they loved and who loved them. And that, I think, is critical because so many of us accept so readily the idea that we don't see our best friends or our moms or our dads because we're working.
That's right.
It's very normal. It's much more normal to move to another city for a career than it is to move to another city to hang out with your friends, right? It's actually one way that this movie affected me is that recognizing this thing that I always knew that was always bugging me. You know, how come since high school I don't get to see my close friends every day like I did in high school? Starting to recognize that in a very scientific, you know, clear way, I moved to Los Angeles to be closer to some of my childhood friends. You know, it's normal to move for a career or a college. But I literally moved here just to be closer to friends, and I think that's one of it's a great idea. It has helped my happiness.
It's not enough, or is it, to pursue your own happiness? Mm. How much of my happiness am I going to gain by pursuing your happiness?
That gets to the really good stuff for me, which is that our happiness is not isolated, and in fact, compassion. Feeling compassion for another person is one of the indicators that a person is much more likely to be happy. So I'll break it down very clearly. Values. If you care about what they call extrinsic values in the scientific world, so if you care about the things that that rely on external justification or adoration, so if you value money, power, fame, good looks, being popular.
Certain office, a certain car, being treated away at a certain restaurant.
Exactly. If those are at the top of your value system, if those are the things that you're shooting for, and those are the things you're spending your life pursuing, you are less likely to be happy than if your values are focused towards compassion, cooperation, wanting to help people, wanting to make the world a better place, wanting to leave a legacy that's something positive. If you care about those things, it doesn't matter if you also want to have a nice car, you know, you also want to live in a safe neighborhood, all those things are fine. But if you prioritize those things, compassion, cooperation, wanting to make the world better, you are more likely to be happier.
And you have someone who left a fairly normal, successful commercial life to work with Mother Teresa's people in India.
That's right. There's a gentleman named Andy Wimmer who the first time I met him was about 10 or 12 years ago. I stepped into Mother Teresa's first home. She has set up, I think, hundreds of these homes around the world, different capacities. But this one is specifically a home for dying people, people who have absolutely been abandoned by everyone, by society, by their families, by the medical system. And so there are people in there with open wounds from being eaten by rats the evening before. They have maggots. They have leprosy, polio, all kinds of conditions that we're lucky for most of us not to have. And yet there are volunteers who come from all over the world to be in that space, to be in that world, to help them with bare hands, with very little medical assistance, and with the one mandate from Mother Teresa, which is not to heal them physically, but simply to show them love, to show these people who have been abandoned that they are loved by somebody and they are loved by God before they die. Andy Wimmer was an aspiring bank director. He wanted to be the youngest bank director in Munich and was really, he said, he was just charging ahead and he was successful and he would go to parties and he dressed really nicely. And then something started itching him a little bit. And so he went on a trip. He took a little sabbatical for a while. And that's where he ended up at Mother Teresa's. And he said a young boy, a 15-year-old boy in very bad shape, finally, after Andy held him, he opened his eyes and looked at him, and Andy said it was like an epiphany. It was like an enlightenment. He said, this is what I knew I had to do, because he'd never felt so alive, and he never felt that his life had so much value and meaning. And he's been there for 17 years.
Wow. So we're just about at the end. Rocco Bellic, what's the low-hanging fruit? What's something really doable that any listener could do as an individual? And then if you have one that we could do as a society,
great,
throw
great.
Me one of each.
Absolutely. For individuals, I'd say the low-hanging fruit definitely is novelty. We have a natural desire to try new things and to experience new things. Now, some of us have it more than others. You know, I would
like... Well, for listeners, that's the first interview we did today.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And as a low-hanging fruit, what it means is you figure out what your parameters are. And it might just simply be driving a different way to work, eating lunch at a different place, deciding to go out to a play instead of a movie over the weekend. Just something that shakes it up. It might be wearing a shirt that's a bright color. You know, next time you go buy a shirt, buy something that's bright. Generally, when people try novel things, they get a little bit of a boost. And to me, that's it opens a can of,
yeah. Well,
whatever the opposite of worms is, it opens a can of possibilities.
Okay. And I don't think we have time for the society question, but... So
we can love each other.
There you go. Okay. The film is Happy, World Happy Day, Saturday, February 11th. To host a screening or to attend one, go to worldhappydayoneword.com. Learn more about the film at thehappymovie.com and more about Rocco's work at wadirum.com, W-A-D-I-R-U-M. Thank you to Rocco Bellic. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Terrence.
Hello, this is Terrence McNally. In the second half, you're going to hear my 2005 conversation with U.S. Teacher of the Year, Rafe Esquith, about the Hobart Shakespeareans, members of his fifth grade classes who performed a Shakespeare play in its entirety every year.
There's a phenomenon in the theaters these days, which most of you must know about, March of the Penguins. They're going to be the second most highest grossing documentary in the history behind Fahrenheit 9/11. I think it may already have hit that mark. There's also another documentary I've been telling people to go see, Mad Hot Ballroom. And today, I have with me the producer, director, and subject of a third documentary called The Hobart Shakespeareans that's going to premiere on PBS nationally September 6th and in LA on KCET September 9th. What I think links these three is that if you recall last year on the show, during the election season, I had a lot of other documentaries as features in the show. Most of them were political. And I feel that when people aren't getting the information they need in the mainstream media, they were turning to documentaries to get depth and context and things they weren't seeing. What I think about the Penguins, Mad Hot Ballroom, which is a ballroom competition in the fifth grade classes of New York City, and the Hobart Shakespeareans, which is about a unique fifth grade class in the inner city of LA that ends up doing a full text Hamlet at the end of the year, is that these are documentaries about goodness, about dedication, about purpose, about treating each other well. And you know, whether it's penguins or fifth graders, there's something in all of these. All of these three films have brought me to tears because there's something that just is so touching when we see the innate goodness of the life force in action and the life force with purpose. When there's so much wrong going on and so much against the life force, we as people need to see these things. So I advise you still, if you can find Mad Hot Ballroom to see it, you can obviously find the Penguin movie, March of the Penguins, September 6th around the country, September 9th in Los Angeles, the Hobart Shakespeareans. Teaching in Los Angeles at one of the nation's largest inner-city grade schools, Hobart Elementary, Rafe Esquith leads fifth graders through an uncompromising curriculum of English, mathematics, geography, literature. The classroom motto is, be nice, work hard. There are no shortcuts. At the end of the semester, every student performs in a full-length Shakespeare play. Despite language barriers, not one of the kids in this particular documentary's family speaks English at home as their first language. Despite those language barriers and the poverty and the rough life that they are surrounded by, many of these Hobart Shakespeareans move on to attend outstanding colleges. Rafe Asquith has very strong ideas about educating today's children of immigrants. He insists on expecting the best from these kids, no matter what their backgrounds are, and he backs up that expectation by giving them the educational resources to defy the odds. As he says, if a 10-year-old who doesn't speak English at home can step in front of you and do a scene from Shakespeare, there is nothing he cannot accomplish. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect hold pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, science, health, politics, environment, education, media, culture, spirit even, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Rafe Asquith grew up in Los Angeles and attended the city's public schools. A 1981 graduate of UCLA, he's taught fifth grade at Hobart Elementary for over 20 years. He's won a Walt Disney American Teacher Award for National Teacher of the Year, Parent Magazine's As You Grow Award, Oprah Winfrey's Use Your Life Award. In 2003, he received the National Medal of Arts. He's the author of There Are No Shortcuts, Changing the World, One Kid at a Time. And he's currently working with the NEA to help put Shakespeare in 10,000 American classrooms. Mel Stewart served as the main film researcher for Walter Cronkite's breakthrough series, The 20th Century. In 1960, he joined the David Walper Organization, and he produced and directed dozens of documentaries, including The Making of the President, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, 4 Days in November, and Wattstacks. He also directed features including Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, the original Willy Wonka movie. His documentary credits include Man Ray, Prophet of the Avant-Garde, and Billy Wilder, the Human Comedy. His television work includes Bill, Ruby, and Oswald. He's been the recipient of 4 Emmys, a Peabody, and an Oscar nomination, and has also been president of the International Documentary Association. Welcome Rafe Asquith and Mel Stewart to KPFK and Free Forum.
Thanks for having us on.
Glad to be here.
My first question always on Free Forum is about guests' personal path to the work that they're doing. So let me start with you, Rafe. Why did you become a teacher and why Hobart Elementary?
Well, I became a teacher because my father taught me that a life without service is a wasted life. I found I had a knack for teaching. I taught at a middle-class school for 2 years. Great kids, but they didn't need me. I was challenged by a principal to come to Hobart School, where there are 2,400 children, and I realized that we were a perfect match. These were kids who want a way out, and I figured out after many years of teaching a way to help them get out.
Okay. And Mel Stewart, what drew you to this documentary, to this subject, this teacher, these kids?
Luck. It's a very important part of being a filmmaker. You have to be lucky. And I was reading the paper. I saw that Rafe had won an award for teaching inner city school children, fifth graders, 9 and 10 years old, many good parts of a curriculum, but above all, it was teaching them how to do Shakespeare, and they had to put on a play every year. And I'm a Shakespeare nut, have been since I was 13 and saw Henry V with Olivier. So I called Rafe and I said, "What play are you doing next year?" And he said, "Hamlet." I said, "Perfect. That's the one I want to do." And I went to meet him, and somehow the chemistry was just right. I put my own money in, and I paid for the first shooting of the picture, and then showed the pieces to PBS in New York, NET and POV, and they said, "Go, do it." And we were on the way. It took a year to finish.
Very good. Let me tell people you're listening to Free Forum on KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming on the web at www.kpfk.org. I'm Terry McNally. I'm speaking with Rafe Asquith, inspirational inner city LA elementary school teacher, author of There Are No Shortcuts, and Mel Stewart, producer-director of The Hobart Shakespearean. It's a documentary on Rafe's work, and it airs on PBS next Tuesday night, September 6th. With A Difference in L.A. on KCET. It airs Friday, September 9th. I tell everyone you should see this film. If you can't see it that night, tape it, TiVo it, or go to the PBS website and buy it. And you can learn more about the project and the film at www.pbs.org. And again, the name of it is The Hobart Shakespeareans. I'm going to jump right back to you, Mel, because one thing you said struck me as reminding me of something I felt. The first thing that I saw when the POV said, "Do you want to, you know, look into this as a subject for the radio show," was the Shakespeare play. Yet when I watched the DVD that you created about Rafe's work, the Shakespeare play is just one part of it. Were you surprised as well?
I was surprised. I went there. I'm going to do Hamlet. But it turned out I found out they were doing baseball, learning to be American citizens, playing baseball. They were doing the most incredible books. Rafe was guiding them through the great books of our literature.
And these are fifth graders, remember?
Yeah, the fifth graders. All fifth grade reading Catcher in the Rye or reading Malcolm X, so forth, Huckleberry Finn. And you see the effect it has on these kids. And if they can do it, and they're just 9 or 10 years old, I only wish that my own children could have gone to Rafe's class. That's the only bad part of it. They didn't go, and they would learn. And the reason for the film is I want the whole nation to know what Rafe can do with children that don't have the background and the money that other children have in this country.
Absolutely. Rafe Esquith, teacher at Hobart Elementary. Tell me a little bit about that turning point you made that you mentioned in the film and in your book about when you went from realizing that you were a pretty good teacher, and you were a teacher kids liked. You'd won the popularity contest, but that you weren't making the difference you needed to make.
I mean, you're too kind the way you say it. The truth is, Terry, I was failing. Because the real measure of a teacher is not that the kids like him or that they do well at the test at the end of the year. The real measure are, where are these children 5 years from now, 10 years from now? What am I giving to these children that they'll be using for the rest of their lives? And it was that night when I was really ready to give it up that my wife, Barbara, said, Rafe, you ought to reread To Kill a Mockingbird. And in Atticus Finch, I found the model that I was looking for. Because Atticus, and early in that book, when his children say, are we going to win? He says no. But he doesn't run from the courtroom. He goes in and fights the fight anyway, because he believes strongly in Tom Robinson's innocence, and he's going to speak the truth. Well, my classroom is that courtroom. And Terry, I feel all the time, I'm a very ordinary human being. But what separates good teachers from other teachers is good teachers do not give up. I tell the children not to give up. That means I can't give up either.
Yeah, one of the things you say, again, it shows up late in the documentary, and I told a friend about it, was you say, you know, I've won these awards, I've written this book, I get this documentary, I could make more money doing something else. And I've been here 20 years, you said, but for 20 years, I've been telling them this is important. And for me to walk away would be to be a hypocrite.
Well, we always say no child left behind. If I walk away, I do see a lot of teachers now who win an award or two, and they write their book and they get their website, and then they leave. So talk about no child left behind. They leave them all behind. I can't do that.
Okay. Tell us again some of the things. We'll talk about the Shakespeare, but some of the other things you do, because as I say, I'm going to say it several times through the show, I want everyone to see this documentary. But you have, I mean, it's basically, it to me looks like a totally unique world inside that classroom. What are some of the other things you've come up with over the years?
Well, we've created a different culture. It's a culture that's different from the neighborhood in which these kids live. It's a culture different from society. We do it through character development. We have the children really develop a code of behavior. Right now, I'm not in the classroom. I'll come back in an hour after I'm done talking to you. And the kids are behaving perfectly because they don't behave for me. And that's what a lot of children do. They please adults. But, you know, I don't want them to please me. I'm a very small part of the story. The real heroes in this film are the children who have the courage to walk the path that I've laid out for them. And that means a push for excellence, because our society doesn't value excellence. And I don't think excellence is a switch you can throw on at 3 o'clock. Hey, now it's Shakespeare time. Now we're going to be excellent. I want them to have a code of excellence in the way they approach their mathematics and their literature and the way they write and the way they speak in front of people and the way they play baseball and travel on the road. It's not a dog and pony show. It's a way of life in room 56.
And you say, I quoted you, that the things that are the most central to this are be nice, work hard, there are no shortcuts. That's really a very simple message. It isn't even make A's. It isn't even pass the standardized test. It isn't even play Hamlet. Where did you come up with that those few simple rules make all the difference?
It really came from one of my former students. You know, good teachers learn from their mistakes, as many young teachers do. I used to believe in my early days, hey, if a kid had high test scores, straight A's in algebra, hey, there's a great kid. Well, not necessarily. I used to find out years later that some of my students who I didn't think were my best students were the ones who were incredibly successful in college and life because they were mastering the skills of being nice and working with others. And I think the reason we don't teach those enough in school, they're harder to teach. You know, given the world in which we live, it's pretty easy to teach a kid his math. But teaching him to be nice in a neighborhood where people beat each other up and shoot each other is a difficult message to get across to children. But just because it's difficult doesn't mean that we as parents and teachers can't make the supreme effort to show them that there is another way to conduct your life.
If I were a young teacher at your school and I said, my God, you know, I walked through the neighborhood to get here this morning. I'm looking at what's around here. I'm looking at the way kids were out on the parking lot. How can you possibly do? How could I do what you do? Again, I'm trying to get like a couple little keys. How do you transform them? Why do they buy in?
Okay, first of all, lesson one, you are the role model. And you have to be the person you want the children to be. I want my kids to work hard, Terry. So I've got to be the hardest worker they've ever seen. It's not a question of preaching. I'm at that school at 6 a.m. That's right there. The kids go, my God, this guy is really going to work hard. I have to work hard. I don't raise my voice to these kids. I don't humiliate these children. I'm a tough teacher, but if I want them to be nice to each other, I better be the nicest guy they ever met. So rule number one, be the person you want the children to be.
Okay. Let me switch over to Mel for a second. I've also got, that was Ray Fesk with the teacher about whom the documentary Hobart Shakespeareans is based on his classroom, where Mel Stewart, award-winning producer and director with the huge honored career, chose to document, and it premieres on PBS Tuesday, September 6th, and in L.A. on KCET Friday, September 9th. You say this is one of your two or three favorite films. Quick question, what are the other two or three?
Willy Wonka and Wattstax.
Very good.
And maybe we throw in Man Ray.
Okay. Why is this one of your favorites in pretty stellar company?
Yeah. Number one, it is the most cinema verite film I've ever met, I ever made, because nothing was reenacted again. Everything was the only take. And Rafe has that incredible quality, which he's shy to admit. He can talk and walk at the same time. And in our business, it's very rare to find somebody who can go about doing what he's doing and yet talk to you and then do his business and the kids don't care. The class goes on and you have a tremendous sense of reality. I never had to ask Rafe a question twice. The right answer always came out of his mouth. Very rare. It's a very rare art. And to be able to do, and Rafe had it. So I knew right away we were on the right track. And it was, there was no retakes. It's just the way it was.
How did you decide to have him speak directly to camera? I know that Frederick Wiseman, in his famous documentaries, doesn't do that. He just shows you what happens. But it's obviously a decision you made. Why?
No, he doesn't talk to camera. He talks to me.
Okay.
And that's very important.
Good.
I don't want him to talk to the camera. Because first of all, it's a very hard thing to look at a camera and be yourself.
I understand.
So he always looked off from the camera and talked whatever thoughts he had. But most of the time, he's walking around the classroom and Rafe's walking this way and that way. And he just has a thought and he just hits me with it. But if he hit the camera with it, it would look false.
Thank you for pointing out my error. You're exactly right. So that this collaboration that the two of you are engaged in, right, over a year includes moments where he's doing this and over his shoulder he goes, basically it's Mel.
Right, and it's the thoughts coming out of his head, but always on the nose, you know. And it's there was a moment when the kids, and we mustn't forget how important all the children are in this. I'm interviewing the little boy that plays Hamlet, and I say to him, what did you think of Huckleberry Finn? How was that? What kind of experience was that for you? He said, well, I thought the characters were interesting and they held a mirror up to nature. A 10-year-old Mexican kid, as part of his speech, has now used that as a phrase. It blew me away.
Yes.
It was just a wonderful moment for me.
I'm Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with Rafe Esquith, the inner city elementary school teacher and author of There Are No Shortcuts, and Mel Stewart, producer-director of The Hobart Shakespeareans, which is a documentary on Rafe's work with these Hobart Shakespeareans, these fifth-grade kids, who none of whom their homes is English the first language. And at the end of this school year, they perform Hamlet full text, full character, and Ian McKellen, visits the classroom. You know, it's nice to be in L.A. and have a reputation. Ian McKellen comes in, and he says that the great thing about these kids is that they understand what they're saying, every word. And he says, I can't say the same about all other Shakespearean actors. And I'm a former actor as well as a former teacher. And believe me, I know that's the truth. I wanted to ask you about one of the points you make even more in the book than in the documentary is the value of reading as like up there above. We've talked about how you're teaching to change their lives, but reading as well is something you find enormously important.
We have a wall of fame in my class where we have all the former students up who are in college now. And I tell the children there are a lot of different kinds of kids up there. There are jocks and there are artists and there are wild kids and there are shy kids. But the one thing they all have in common is they all read for pleasure and they all read well. One of the things that's wrong with the schools today is that in trying to throw Basel readers at the children and, you know, they take all their tests and everything, has anybody ever asked the children how they feel about the reading program? The kids hate it. They despise the reading program. And yes, the companies will say, oh, but the test scores are going up. Their goals have to do with fluency and speed. My goals have to do with pleasure and passion and enjoyment. And when there's a scene in the film when the kids are reading Huck Finn and are absolutely in tears as Huck has to decide between heaven and hell.
Let me interrupt for a second. That is so powerful because you've just got a camera there catching a few of the kids. And they're in a school classroom. They're coming to a point in the book and they cannot control themselves.
No. And that's what reading is supposed to be. So, I mean, we just finished Tom Sawyer, and to hear the kids hysterically laughing as Tom hoodwinks his friends into whitewashing the fence. This is why my class's reading scores are so high, because my kids love to read. They read all the time. And it's not because I'm such a good teacher. I put so many great books in front of them. We forget, you know, Mark Twain's a great product. Children read him in the 1800s. It's not that I'm such a whiz. We've just forgotten. There are so many great works of literature, and let's give the kids the benefit of the doubt with the right teaching and the right parents. They're going to read these books.
Yeah, and Mel mentioned some of them, but it is the autobiography of Malcolm X, To Kill a Mockingbird, Catcher in the Rye, things that most students, my guess is, might hit at eighth grade, probably high school. And you're just bringing them into fifth graders, and these are fifth graders who, most of them, as I said, in their home, most of them are either Asian or Latino, and in their home, English is not the first language.
Right, and there's a key to that also. When they do get thrown Steinbeck or Twain in the eighth or ninth grade and are told, go home and read this, many children are going to home environments where reading, it's just not conducive for reading. That's why we read these books together in the class. And when people say to me, gosh, Rafe, this takes a long time, I say, well, you know, so what? I'm not in a hurry. That's when I say there are no shortcuts, that's for teachers too. We can't look for these simplistic solutions to complicated problems.
Tell the story of where the there are no shortcuts comes from.
Again, I'm a learner, and I once took kids to the Hollywood Bowl to see the great cellist Lynn Harrell play. And Lynn loved my class so much, he pulled his kids out of private school in Beverly Hills and put them at Hobart. And one of his kids went on.
There's an endorsement.
Yeah. It was pretty funny to have these two white kids at Hobart. They're great kids. One of them wound up at Vassar, and one of them wound up at Princeton. And they're still in touch with me all the time. But we went backstage to visit Lynn, and I had a young cellist who looked up at Lynn Harrell, who's 6'5". And the little kid said, you know, I play the cello, Mr. Harrell, but it doesn't sound like that. How do you do it? And Lynn just looked down and said, well, there are no shortcuts. This is when I was in about my fifth or sixth year of teaching. And I said, boy, that encapsulates everything I'm trying to get across to these children.
Yeah, it's in a banner in the front of the classroom. And it comes up several times during the it's something they know. And so when you go to it, it's almost like a tribe who has a certain set of iconic rules.
Well, you know, I always, being in Los Angeles and loving basketball, I always used to tell the children, you know, they call him Magic Johnson. There's nothing magic about Magic Johnson. This talented man worked for hundreds of thousands of hours in lonely gyms when there weren't people cheering him on to create that magic. There are no shortcuts.
Right. Let me ask, we've only got a couple of more minutes. Let me ask you a couple of questions. It seems to me that the some of what you do might be controversial. You openly tell the children you want a better life for them than the one their school, their neighborhoods, the other kids in that school, perhaps even their families, offer. There's a scene in the bus when you're on the way back from Washington, and you say, how many want to go back to Hobart? How many want to go back to your neighborhoods? You take them to hotels. You raise money through a nonprofit. You take them to hotels. You take them to good restaurants. What's that message, and do you get flack for it?
I don't get flack for it. As a matter of fact, I've got 60 kids showing up at 6:30 in the morning.
I'm in flack from other teachers.
Flack from
or
other
politically
teachers.
Correct folk.
Sure, I do. I teach with 125 teachers, and most of them are incredibly nice to me, and 8 or 10 of them believe I am the Antichrist. And that's okay. You know, the best teacher who ever lived, Harry, was Socrates, and they killed him.
Exactly.
So if they're not shooting at me sometimes, I'm probably not doing anything right. But I do want a better life for these kids, and surely to say you live in a neighborhood where you hear gunfire at night, this is not the best thing in their future when there are other children in America who don't have to go to bed with that. I'm just trying to level the playing field.
I'm going to throw out two things that we don't have time to ask you about. I'm just going to mention them, then I'm going to go to the close. And one is you do this money system where they actually, when they come to school, they pay money for their seat. If you sit close to the front, you pay more to rent that seat. You get money when you achieve things. And if you are sick and miss a test, you docked money because in real life you say, you know, there's no excuses,
and
there's no shot.
It is play money. It's not real
yes,
money, folks.
It's play money. And then you have auctions, but I mean, right. It's not real money. But there's that. But there's a sense of reality there that's phenomenal. So again, the book is There Are No Shortcuts. The POV film is The Hobart Shakespearean. Thank you, Rafe Asquith. Thank you, Mel Stewart. Keep up the good work. Watch this documentary. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. So that's terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, one word, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. That's all one word, a world that just might work. And they're the same website. Now, if you want to receive my weekly email announcement of guests and issues, plus I usually put in 8 to 10 articles that flesh out the conversation we're having, plus some things that I think are relevant, timely, and maybe even attention-getting in terms of what's wrong and solutions that are happening, you can sign up at my site or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally at mac, mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast at Apple Podcasts and many other podcast sites. Some of you may still look at Apple Podcasts as iTunes. That works as well. And you can find years of podcasts at my site. Listen anytime, anywhere. Archives include Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence, McNally, TerrenceE. Thanks to Mark Maxwell in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely.